You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you live from Washington, D.C. And fascinating watching the speeches last night at the Republican convention. It seemed like everybody was interested in talking about themselves and their own state. John Kasich spent a lot of time bragging about how President Obama saving the auto industry had made Ohio, you know, do really, really well. And Chris Christie talked a lot about lessons from his mother. I'm going to be playing. We've got a whole little riff on that that we'll get to in a few seconds. Didn't mention that he's got one of the worst unemployment rates in the state. So anyway, John Nichols was actually there. Our old friend John Nichols, the Washington reporter, Washington correspondent and author of Uprising for The Nation magazine, thenation.com. Hey, John, welcome back.
Hey, Tom, it's great to be with you. And I do want to say that I thought of you. I'm not making this up. I thought seriously of you last night.
Why is that?
At a particular point in the remarks. When former Northern Exposure star Janine Turner was brought on to explain the thinking of the founders.
Oh, interesting. I didn't see that piece of it.
Oh, Tom, you really need to see that.
What? What happened?
She's a militant Tea Party. She was the nice girl on Northern Exposure.
Right.
Now she's become a real right winger. She's a militant Tea Party person who basically quotes the founders so selectively.
Right.
In order to make the case for the Tea Party, that it's a fascinating thing. You could, and knowing you and knowing your good writing on these issues, I mean, you could write a book just on her speech.
Amazing. I'll have to check it out.
Every bad analogy and, you know, kind of misguided theory you could imagine.
Yeah.
All wrapped up in 8 minutes.
Was there a sense among the delegates there, the Republicans who were there, that all these people who were speaking? I mean, traditionally, you and I have covered a lot of conventions over a lot of years. Traditionally, when you get up to give a speech, a major, you know, primetime speech, you talk about the candidate. You pitch the candidate, you know, and it didn't happen last night. Every single one of these guys got up and you know, the first half, three quarters, four fifths of their speech was all about them and their states. And then they said, oh, by the way, there's this guy, Mitt Romney, he's running for president. You ought to vote for him. But let me talk a little bit more about me. I mean, that's how it seemed to go.
It was, you know, Chris Christie's speech. Chris Christie went through 1,800 words and, you know, a substantial portion of his speech without ever mentioning Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
I mean, it was only late in the speech that it's kind of like, and one hopes it was in the text, you know.
Yeah.
He didn't just put him, oh, man, I'm about to sit down and I haven't mentioned Mitt Romney.
And on TV, they were doing cutaways to Romney, and you could see this look on his face like, hey, wait a minute. This is, I mean, he looked, angry is not quite this, you know, it's a little too strong a word. He looked like a businessman, you know, trying to figure something out. You know what I mean? And I'll bet he was thinking, wait a minute, this is supposed to be my coronation. These people are supposed to be telling the world how wonderful I am. Why is this guy talking about his mother's lessons to him in life?
Yeah. And listening to Darkness on the Edge of Town.
Yeah.
And many of these,
or a Bronx Tale.
Yeah. And people like, you know, Mia Love and all these other folks, you know, doing their bios, and then these, you know, bringing up business people who are talking about how, you know, they're really mad at the federal government because they didn't get their SBA loan. And, you know, it was a bizarre night. And unfortunately, to my mind, at its darkest, it had the flavor, the tenor of kind of old school propaganda. I mean, what authoritarian state have you ever been in where every speaker had to at some point graft on referencing to the theme of the night? And so speaker after speaker, you know, was talking about all sorts of different things, and then they'd say somehow, and we built it, you know, and you're like, okay, I got that. That's the theme of the night.
Yeah.
This is getting a little bizarre.
Yeah.
And,
well, you know,
it sounded like they didn't write their own speeches, most of them, that they were basically handed a script.
You think so? I think that if the Romney campaign was in charge of those speeches,
Romney campaign was in charge of those speeches.
Yeah.
I think they were handed speeches by Republican mandarins who were given the responsibility to create a thematic evening. where a message was.
Okay, so the you know, let's say a few paragraphs of each speech, in other words.
Yeah.
Because I can't imagine that the Romney campaign was happy with, you know, Kasich spending, you know, 8 minutes talking about how wonderful Ohio is, or you know, Christie talking about, you know, the being loved rather than feared and vice versa.
Yeah. Well, and think about this. If there had been, and I agree with you totally, I think they just had, you know, go to theme, go to message. But they didn't look for a coherent whole.
But shouldn't the message be elect Mitt Romney? Mitt Romney's a good guy? They never really got to that.
And here's the bizarre thing. They actually broke their own message. Here you have Ann Romney, and you can love her or hate her, but I think the woman gave a relatively solid speech that had some strength to it. I didn't necessarily agree with it, but she got through some barriers and I think spoke about things rather well, used the word love a lot, and then you follow her up with a guy who says, we don't want to be loved, we want to be respected.
Right. Yeah,
you're actually countering her message.
The Ann Romney speech I thought was really poignant and kind of tragic in a way, because she talked about how she, in the course of campaigning, she had traveled all across America and she had met single mothers, and she was telling these stories of the, you know, single mothers and unemployed people and people living on the edge and, you know, just barely getting by, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then she said something about you know, moms with, you know, screaming kids or something. And she said, that's one I understand, or words to that effect. And you suddenly got it, that this is a woman who's been living in a bubble, who's throwing out some examples of poor people she met as if to say, you know, I get it, you know, or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she really doesn't get it. I mean, it was so much a, you know, lady from the Hamptons telling, you know, it was really, I mean, you know, God bless her. She seems like a sweet person, but what a sad speech in so many ways, in my opinion.
I agree with you. This was a corporate CEO wife.
Yes.
Vaughn
Williams is right.
She was given a responsibility. And, you know, and sometimes when you're part of this, you know, I think it's always wrong to think of a corporate wife or a CEO's wife as doing nothing. That's an absurdity. No. They have huge responsibilities, and it is to, you know, back this guy up in sometimes difficult situations, to humanize. And that was her job.
I was surprised that there was nothing in her speech, in Ann Romney's speech, that actually humanized Mitt. She talked about how he made her laugh and when they met. But she never told, you know, typically when you're trying to communicate a story or a message, you wrap it in a story. You come up with an anecdote. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, speech giving 101. And there should have been a story that we all remember about a time back 15 years ago when one of their kids was sick and Mitt decided that he was going to fly in from Salt Lake City and help out. You know, there was no story.
You know,
so there's no sense of who the hell this guy is, other than that she thought he was the handsomest guy in the room and probably the richest.
Yeah. Or when I got sick, he assigned one of his best drivers to take me to the hospital.
Exactly.
It kind of had the feel of that. And the most tragic part, I thought, and again, I don't want to pick on her too much because I thought she actually did, in many ways, a better speech than Christie.
Yeah.
But the most bizarre part was when she said, you know, that when you're diagnosed with MS and when you're diagnosed with breast cancer, that she pauses and says, well, folks, it's a real marriage.
Yeah.
Okay. And I actually understand what she's trying to say.
Sure. That was the most human moment, frankly, of the whole speech.
Yeah. But she didn't take it anyplace. And so we're left with this sort of bizarre sense.
And she could have used those as examples of how Mitt has supported her, and but maybe he hasn't. Maybe he's just been busy.
How he would not let other people.
Maybe he hired an extra butler for her. You know.
Yeah. It was a fascinating. I mean, in that sense, it was a very fascinating night. But
amen.
I think it was a successful night.
Yep. Hang on, John.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, thenation.com. Thank you, John.
It is a great pleasure to be with you, Tom. Keep it up.
You too. We'll talk soon.
Tonight, I want to talk to you from my heart about our hearts. Tonight, I want to talk to you about love.
Oh, what's love got to do? Got to do with it.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. And on the line with us live from the RNC is Jim Pinkerton. And Jim, you, excuse me just a second. Shane, oh, he's not. He's sitting down right now. Okay. He's on the way. And Shane, you have his bio. Why don't you just pop your mic open and tell us who Jim Pinkerton is, please?
Sure. Jim Pinkerton works for Fox News. He's worked for the Bush administration. He actually, I think, was Dan Quayle's chief of staff as well. You can see him on the weekends on Fox News on the Fox News Watch.
Uh-huh. So. Okay. Great. So we'll and Jim will be with us any second now. There he is. Here we go. See, somebody's got to put some headphones on him, though, or he can't hear us. So, all right. He's still getting ready. Oh, man. It's, you know, things move along slowly, right, sometimes. So let's – and we just lost the Skype. Marty in – let's pick up some calls here. Marty in Boston, Mass. Hey, Marty, what did you think of the what you saw last night on TV?
Well, I just thought you've been a little critical, but everybody else has given Mrs. Romney way too much of a free pass. When she mentioned her MS and cancer, you know, I feel bad for her. I don't wish that on anybody. But they don't think at all about the people at the companies that went bankrupt. Those people, their illnesses.
Who might have MS and cancer and no longer have health insurance.
Right. And the first thing her husband's going to do, if he gets elected, is make sure that health insurance companies can drop them again.
Right.
Those people think about nobody but themselves.
Yeah, it is very much the culture of selfishness, and I, you know, I frankly thought Ann Romney came across as a personable high society lady, and you know, who was trying to say that she understood the average person, and was not successful in doing so. So
she not only doesn't understand the average person, she doesn't acknowledge that we exist. We don't exist in her world.
You know, to a large extent, we don't. I mean, they travel in their private jets and their limousines and gated communities and all that kind of thing. And there's, you know, I doubt that she's ever walked into a 7-Eleven and bought anything, you know, for example. So, Marty, thanks a lot for the call. Eileen in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Eileen, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I started listening to the speech last night. And first of all, I kind of got a little insulted because after pissing so many women off, and she's trying to pander to us and get, bring us back. And it was really insulting to me. And then when she started talking about how they had to eat off a sawhorse and an ironing board canned tuna.
Yeah. When she said that, I said to Louise, wait a minute, both their parents are multimillionaires?
I mean, he grew up in the Beverly Hills of Michigan.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're eating off an ironing board. It just didn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
So that's when I turned it off.
Yeah. I, you know, it was a non sequitur. It was a very odd non sequitur. How
right.
could she be claiming poverty with the incredible riches? And you know, plus they're going to, you know, five star schools, you know, the very best there are. So it was
probably never been in the same room with a dirty diaper, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Thank you very much, Eileen. Chuck in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hey, Chuck, what's on your mind today?
Love your show, as does everyone else. When I was listening to Christie's speech last night, which mm-hmm. I really thought was a well-done speech, one of the first themes was talking about vote for who you respect over who you like.
Right.
I think an obvious intent was going for independents who like Obama, trying to convince them that they should respect Romney, that he's better. But right. I kept sitting there thinking, well, if this last night was supposed to be about getting people to like Romney, it sounded more like an acknowledgement of, well, we know you don't like Mitt, but you ought to vote for him out of respect.
Yeah.
And that was just a...
It could have been. You know, the other possibility, you know, Chris Christie's from New Jersey. He's a big fan of kind of mobster movies and things like that. I mean, he kind of talks like one at times, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And do you ever see A Bronx Tale? the movie, A Bronx Tale?
No.
Okay, well, here's a little clip from it. It's we'll play about maybe 20, 25 seconds of it. And I'm wondering if Chris Christie saw this a couple of years ago. When did this movie come out, Shana? About a decade ago. Okay. I'm wondering if he saw this movie. I mean, he attributed it to his mother, which I found not very credible. But just listen to this.
Is it better to be loved or feared?
That's a good question. It's nice to be both, but it's very difficult. But if I had my choice, I would rather be feared.
Yeah, and then he goes on to explain. In fact, why don't you continue? Just okay, we're running out of time. But anyhow, so this is two mobsters talking to each other, and the other one says, you know, it's better to be feared than to be loved. And then he explains, you know, love will come and go, but fear will never go away. And you know, black quack 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 quack. And I'm just wondering if Chris Christie essentially plagiarized A Bronx Tale. So
he very well may have.
Yeah,
it seemed to be more of getting a good feeling about the Republican Party, at least from Christie, than to actually promote Romney. Thought it was interesting. I'm both looking forward to and dreading watching tonight, as are my pets and my wife.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I wouldn't recommend turning it into a drinking game, but just because, you know, I mean, you know, alcohol intoxication and poisoning, in fact, you know, can be a bad thing, but it has been a very bizarre show. Chuck, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks a lot for listening. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
28 minutes past the hour. Your impressions of last night's RNC speeches, as well as mine. I got a whole bunch more to share with you here.
She told me there would be times in your life when you have to choose between being loved and being respected. Now, she said to always pick being respected.
That's very interesting. It reminds me a lot of a little clip from A Bronx Tale, the movie A Bronx Tale. Let me just hear a little piece of that.
Is it better to be loved or feared?
That's a good question. It's nice to be both, but it's very difficult. But if I had my choice, I would rather be feared. Fear lasts longer than love.
Yeah.
Friendships that are bought with money mean nothing.
Yeah, and he goes on like this, and, you know, was it really his mother? Jim Pinkerton is on the line with us. He was a former advisor to the Bush administration, regular panelist on Fox News Watch, Fox News contributor. Jim, what else? What am I missing from your bio here? I'm sorry, what I have is incomplete.
Well, that's all right. What I'm here in Tampa at the Republican convention to talk about the corporate income tax. I was interested in what you said in the previous segment. I'm actually the co-chair of a group called the RATE Coalition. That's Reforming America's Taxes Equitably. Uh-huh. And since down here in Tampa, I've been having some fun. I don't know if you can see it, and I've got a red foam finger like you have at, you know, baseball games and so on.
Uh-huh.
We're number one. That is, we're number one in terms of having the highest corporate income tax in the developed world.
In theory, we're not number one in actual tax collections, though. We're like something like 38 in tax collections, as you know.
Well, we are way higher than the OECD average, that's for sure. And the fact of the matter is that if American corporations face a 35% marginal tax rate when they think about new investments and they decide whether to move, you were saying earlier, right, corporations are moving overseas.
Yeah.
The Eaton Corporation.
Yeah, these corporations, they don't give a rat's ass about America.
Well, maybe not, but what you and I care about Cleveland.
I care about America. I am a patriotic American. I will pay my taxes. I will keep my company here, and I'm not going to move offshore just so that my CEO can jump his salary from $500 million a year to $900 million a year.
Fair enough. But what do we do then about the fact that when I was born, back in the, well, 2 years after I was born in 1958, in 1960. The U.S. had 17 of the 20 largest corporations in the world headquartered in the United States. Now we have six.
Wait, in 1960, you realized that 32% of the total income, the total federal income, was from corporate income taxes. Right now it's 7%.
Right, and what's happened is the world has globalized, and it's now plausible for an American company to think to themselves, gee, do I want to be in Canada where the rate will soon be 15%? Do I want to be in the UK where it will soon be 23%? Do I want to be in Ireland where it's 12.5%?
Right.
And
so isn't it time for us to stop saying let's race to the bottom and start saying let's go back to what Alexander Hamilton proposed in 1791 that was adopted in 1793 and that stood until the days of Reagan, which was, you know, policies that actually protect the U.S. economy. China's doing it. Taiwan's doing it. Japan's doing it. South Korea's doing it. Brazil's doing it. Brazil just passed a law that said that on any cell phone, any smartphone in that, that's sold in that country, there was a 50% import tariff if it wasn't manufactured in Brazil. What happened? Foxconn, the company that makes Apple's phones, built a factory in Brazil, and they're employing thousands of people. Brazil, these countries are smart. And then here in America, we've got, you know, you and the guys of the Republican Party are running around going, oh, let's just cut taxes and have a race to the bottom. There's always going to be a country with lower taxes.
Well, the question is, do we want to be triple Ireland?
No, the question is, do we want to have rational trade policies?
Well, look. You asked me what I'm doing down here, and I'm doing this point on the corporate tax, and I'm saying that. And for example, in 2000, you know, your point about trade doesn't really speak to why corporate headquarters move around. I mean, in 2000, the United States had 179 of the top 500 corporations in the world. Now we have 133. That's not a trade issue. There's nothing stopping Company X from moving their issue to their manufacturing.
Well,
to
most
China.
Of these corporations have hundreds of offshore divisions to begin with. I mean,
headquarters, when the corporate headquarters moves, the city, the state, the U.S. economy as a whole loses those jobs. And so I think you just have to realize that when in 1986, when President Reagan and the Democrats in Congress worked together to cut the top corporate rate from 46 to 34, the OECD average is 50. Now the OECD average is 25. They've cut their corporate tax rate in half. And we have actually pumped it up 1 point back
but
in the 90s.
But they're actually collecting that. GE is paying nothing in taxes. Okay. ExxonMobil is paying nothing in taxes. You know, the vast majority, in fact, of American corporations pay nothing in taxes.
The rate coalition says that, look, in return for getting the rate to 25, we support whatever other base broadening measures might be indicated to get to that point. Look, we agree it is crazy to have some corporations paying in the 30s, which some do, and some companies paying zero. That's why we want
what
the same
corporations
kind of
paying in the 30s?
Pardon?
I know of no American corporation that's paying in the 30s.
Some of the members of the rate coalition pay in the 30s.
Can you name one, please?
Some of our members, it's not a secret, but the Tax Foundation has said that the effective tax rate for American corporations is in the mid to high 20s.
It's 11%.
Well, no, that's percentage of revenues, but of federal revenues. If the effective tax
rate... No, 7% of federal revenues. I may be wrong on the number, but I thought it was 11%. Maybe it's in the teens, but...
In any case...
It certainly is the 35%.
If your argument is that every corporation ought to pay something, we agree. How's that? We agree.
Okay.
That's what the rate coalition... And the rate coalition is, you know, Verizon, AT&T, Disney, Boeing... These are big companies, the National Retail Federation, between the 27 companies and associations that we represent, that's 30 million people working in the United States, United States. And we're saying that, yes, if you need to make the tax code more simple and clear.
So you represent a group of corporations who want to write tax policy. Shouldn't we, the people, be writing tax policy?
Of course you should, which is why we're working with, for example, Dave Camp, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Richard Neal, Democrat of Massachusetts, Bill Nelson, Democrat of Florida, Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, as well as other Republicans, including Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan. It'll be a congressional thing. The Republicans in both houses of Congress have effectively endorsed this. President Obama himself, in the 2011 State of the Union address, said it is a problem that we have the highest corporate tax rate.
Yeah, I am not opposed to our dropping our top corporate tax rate from 35 down to 25% if we would start enforcing it.
Well, that's exactly what we're talking about. You should look at our website. I'm glad we're talking, Tom, because our website is ratecoalition.com, and this is exactly what we've been arguing. Again,
But the larger point here, Jim Pinkerton, is that these corporations that are leaving the United States for the lower taxes, I mean, this is like, you know, oh, no, look at this. They're moving their factories to Mexico. And then Mexico started getting expensive. Oh, no, they're moving to China. Well, now they're moving to Vietnam. Pretty soon they're going to be moving to Burma. I mean, there's always going to be cheaper labor. It's the exact same thing with taxes. There's always going to be a company. I mean, Mitt Romney's partying on a yacht right now off Tampa that is flying the flag of the Caymans because it's cheaper if you own a yacht to register it in the Caymans. I mean, there's always going to be that race to the bottom. Shouldn't we be putting place policies right now that protect American manufacturing and American manufacturers, American companies, companies that actually want to be part of this country?
I think that the reality we face is that capital is mobile. And I'll give you a great example of how this works in the real world. Okay, Sweden is commonly thought of as sort of a left-wing social democratic country. In fact, their corporate rate, because they know they're competing against all those other countries in Europe as well as around the world, their corporate rate is 26.3. And we'll get to that. Here's the punchline. So the finance minister of Sweden, a guy named Anders Borg, B-O-R-G, said, you know, look, we got a problem here in Sweden because AstraZeneca, the big pharmaceutical company, is actually sort of Anglo-Swedish. It could sort of choose which domicile it wants to be in. And so if the UK cuts its corporate rate, as they're planning to do, down to 23 or 22, then the problem that Sweden will face is that the AstraZeneca could then pay its taxes in the UK and then create a cost account for its expenses.
And that's the point at which you use policy. You say, well, that's fine. If you're going to domicile yourself in another country, then we're going to consider your products imports. And as imports, we're going to attach a tariff to them, and we are going to get that money one way or the other. If you want to make money off the Swedish consumers, if you want to make money off American workers, and you're going to try to avoid paying the taxes that keep America great, then we're not going to allow you to do that.
Well, you got a WTO problem there.
Let's pull out of the WTO. The WTO is insane.
Well, okay. I mean, Tom, politics is the art of the possible. And so what the rate coalition says is that here's one reform, repeat reform. And the title of the group is Reforming America's Taxes. And so we're saying as a reform, let's broaden the base. Let's do what they did in 86, which is a lot of loophole closings, a lot of base broadening, a lot of extra revenue coming in from income that hadn't previously been taxed. It's the model of the 86 Tax Reform Act. It was also the model applied by the Simpson-Bowles Commission, by the Rivlin-Domenici Commission, by the Gang of Six in the Senate, which is a bipartisan group.
But for 35 years, as a consequence of Reaganomics, as a consequence of these tax changes that Reagan did, although, you know, he did raise the capital gains tax up to 28% for 1 year. But nonetheless, as a consequence of all these things, what we've seen is that, you know, for 60 years, productivity has been steadily increasing. But ever since Reagan, wages have been flattened right out.
I think there's a lot of productivity going on in this country. I see a lot of good stuff happening. But
that's my point.
We want more.
But, yeah, okay. Jim, you know, we've run out of time, so we'll leave it at that. Jim Pinkerton, former advisor of the Bush administration. You're there at the RNC working with the Romney administration. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Hey, Jim, you still there?
Thanks.
Jim, what's your website? No, he's stepping off. Okay, I wanted to plug it for him. Anyhow, we'll be right back. Propaganda. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Larry in Martinsburg, West Virginia. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind?
Yeah, a couple of points, Tom. First, I'm glad to see you back on the air again.
Thank you. Me too.
A couple of points. The quotation that Chris Christie made, I think it originates actually with Machiavelli. I think it's from The Prince, and I think it was used in that movie.
You're right.
They boosted it.
You're right. It is from The Prince. You're absolutely right. It's been two decades since I read it, but I know it's in there. You're absolutely right.
The other point is just listening to Jim Pinkerton summarizing his argument. It seems to be that what he's arguing is that as Americans, we need to capitulate to corporate extortion.
Right.
When you make the argument that other countries have lower tax rates, and you're absolutely spot on when we say that our corporations don't pay the real tax rate. But the argument he's making is a race to the bottom. It is a kind of blackmail, and that doesn't seem like a very bold position for the Republicans to make.
Yeah, it's the ultimate wimp out, actually.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely.
You know, and that's why I think there should be some kind of consequence. It's like Bernie Sanders on this program once suggested, and he's never been successful in trying to get it into law because, you know, Congress won't go along with it, but once suggested that any corporation, any American company that engages in one state or one municipality competing, you know, putting them in competition with each other. Like when Boeing said, okay, we're going to move our headquarters, this is going to give us a big deal, the best deal. And Chicago said, well, we'll give you $200 million worth of freebies if you come here. And then South Carolina, we'll give you $300 million now. Whatever, you know, it's like all over. And everybody was competing to race to the bottom to get Boeing's headquarters there. Bernie said any state that engages in that kind of activity with a corporation should lose their federal highway funds, which would put a screeching halt to it. So then how do we do it internationally? Well, internationally, my answer would be that any company that is not domiciled in the United States and doesn't pay taxes in the United States but wants to sell product in the United States, their product is considered a foreign product, even if it's manufactured in the United States, and they have to pay tariffs on it.
Yeah. I agree completely. You're exactly right about
yeah.
that.
Yeah, because if we don't do something rational like that, you're absolutely right. This is extortion, and we are going to have an insane race to the bottom, and it is just wrong. Larry, thanks a lot for the call. Brilliant comment.
Well, you're quite welcome.
I appreciate it. Perry in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Perry, what's up?
Hey, Tom. There's one part of Christie's speech that he did get right at basically 1958. On his speech, he made the statement, all must share in the sacrifice. Any leader that tells us differently is simply not telling us the truth.
Right, but what he was really saying is he wants to cut Medicare, Social Security. He wants, you know, all the people, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe the billionaires can kick in an extra $50.
Yeah, but then earlier in his speech, what's forced bipartisan compromise? That sounds more like the... when we were arguing about the national debt.
Right. Yeah, forced bipartisan compromise. It sounds like an oxymoron. I honestly don't know what it means. You know, thanks for bringing up the issue. Susan in Casper, Wyoming. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I feel like the corporations and the CEOs and that kind of thing, they're taking our wealth out of our country and stealing it from us.
Yeah, and nobody's stopping them.
And nobody's stopping them.
In fact, the plan for the Republican Party is to make it easier for them.
Yes, yes.
It's crazy.
And I, you know, I am amazed that, you know, they stand there and say they love this country, yet they're intentionally causing it to go bankrupt just due to their greed. Their yeah. greed is more important to them than our country.
Yeah. Well, that's
so
the...
why should they be able to represent our country?
Maybe when the Republicans flipped the stars upside down on their logo, they didn't mean to flip it into the satanic star. They meant the greed star. This is the new logo for greed. I don't know. You originally called, though, Susan, according to my
yes.
call screen software here, about Ann Romney's speech. You wanted to comment on that?
Yes, I did. And I have a huge interest in the Romneys, negative, of course. And I've watched her in several interviews. And mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone's brought this to your attention, but when she wants to make a point, she takes her index finger and points at the interviewer or at the audience or, you know, who's ever she at some point she
right.
will point at you like you are less than her, that
right.
you know, like a teacher would point her finger, you know, you're bad
right.
and you listen to me. And she did that when she said, you know, I want you to hear me, there will be, and I you know, not quoting, but
she actually
no
at one point did say
taxes.
I want you to hear me, this is very important, now listen to this, or words to that effect.
Right, and she said, there will be no more tax returns released.
Yeah.
And she was pointing that index finger at and leaning forward. I'm talking about her body language.
Yeah.
It says a lot more than her words.
Yeah. I am curious about the help. One of the things that I've discovered, not being rich and famous myself, but I know a few people who are, and I've been in the homes of several, I don't know, a dozen, maybe fewer than 100 certainly, people who are genuinely really, really rich. And what is not at all uncommon is that if the help, the cook, the maid, the butler, the person who's bringing around the drinks, whatever, if they establish eye contact with you, they are fired immediately.
Oh, yes. It goes back to
the European kings. You know,
yes,
the courtiers, their courtiers or whatever, you know, they were not allowed to establish eye contact with the royal family. And that's very much the case with many wealthy families, is that if the help establishes eye contact with a member of the family, then they're immediately fired. And I'm curious how it is in the Romney family, how, you know, because... your thing about Anne's, you know, the kind of ambiance or the kind of attitude that she has, it'd be fascinating to have one of their butlers or one of their chefs or, you know, one of their kids' nannies or whatever write a book about it. Maybe someday we'll learn. Susan, thank you very much for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli. What year was that written? That was some long time ago, wasn't it? He was trying to get a gig with the King of Italy, as I recall, and he ultimately didn't get the job, but he wrote this book as his job application, as it were, and the book endures. And the prince is like, basically how to be Machiavellian. 1513. Thank you, Shano. The Prince was published. And in chapter 17, titled Concerning Cruelty and Clemency and Whether It's Better to Be Loved Than to Be Feared, Machiavelli wrote, every prince ought to desire to be considered clement and not cruel. In other words, compassionate and not cruel. Upon this, a question arises, whether it's better to be loved than feared, or feared than loved. It may be answered that one should wish to be both, but because it's difficult to unite them in one person, it is much safer to be feared than loved, when of the two, either must be dispensed with. Because this is to be general, because this is to be asserted in general of men, that they are ungrateful, fickle, false, cowardly, covetous, and as long as you succeed, they are yours entirely. They will offer you their blood, property, life, and children, as is said above, when the need is far distant. But when it approaches, they turn against you. And that prince who relies entirely on their promises has neglected other precautions is ruined, because friendships are obtained by payments. In other words, he's talking about how people can be two-faced and all that kind of thing. So, therefore, men have less scruple in offending one who is beloved than in one who is feared, for love is preserved. You know, and it's actually, this is, you know, 15th, 16th century language. So, nevertheless, he says, a prince ought to inspire fear in such a way that if he does not win love, he avoids hatred. Fascinating. So, Chris Christie, let's play these clips from Chris Christie's speech last night. Clip number one, please.
The greatest lesson that Mom ever taught me, though, was this one. She told me there would be times in your life when you have to choose between being loved and being respected. Now, she said to always pick being respected.
Yeah, clip number two.
I believe we have become paralyzed by our desire to be loved. Now, our founding fathers had the wisdom to know that social acceptance and popularity were fleeting, and that this country's principles needed to be rooted in strengths greater than the passions and the emotions of the times. But our leaders today have decided it's more important to be popular, to say and do what's easy, and say yes rather than to say no, when no is what is required.
And in Machiavelli, he talks about Hannibal. He gives the example. Among the wonderful deeds of Hannibal, this one is enumerated, that having led an enormous army composed of many various races of men to fight in foreign lands, no dissensions arose among either them or against the prince, Hannibal, whether in his bad or in his good fortune. This arose from nothing else than his inhuman cruelty, which with his boundless valor made him revered, in other words, respected, and terrible in the sight of his soldiers. But without that cruelty, his other virtues were not sufficient to produce this effect. In other words, it's better to be respected and feared than to be loved. The Prince, Niccolo Machiavelli, chapter 17. You can read it yourself. Really interesting to have Chris Christie channeling Machiavelli at the Republican National Convention. And by the way, talk about Machiavelli in actions. Here's a guy who goes on stage in what is supposed to be the love fest for Mitt Romney. This is the nominating convention for Mitt Romney. He officially won the nomination earlier in the day when, what was it, New Jersey pushed him over the top, was it Shano? And New Jersey pushed him over the top. He's going to be, you know, if you're a Republican and you're gung-ho, the next president of the United States. And what does Chris Christie do? He gets up and for 1,800 words, for two-thirds of his speech, he talks about himself and the stories that his mother taught him and the lessons that his mother taught him. And you're absolutely right, Shano. Shelley Adelson now is throwing $500,000 to Shelley Boteach, Shmuley, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. We had him on the TV show last night. I've known Shmuley for years. He's a decent guy. He's a conservative, but he's a decent guy. And he decided to run for Congress. And Shelley Adelson says, here's $500,000. So in New Jersey, in Chris Christie's state, you've got a congressional district that's being bought by Shelley Adelson. And, I asked Shmuley Boteach about that last night. Don't you feel like you're being bought? He's like, no, this is free speech. This is America. This is how this stuff should work. You know, it's not a verbatim quote, but amazing stuff. Absolutely amazing stuff. Jim in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Jim, thanks for listening to KPTK.com. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Great show today. Great show. That interview with Pinkerton, you did a great job. I thought you pinned him down several times. But one thing I noticed he said that just shocked me. I was amazed that he said it. He said, you were talking about jobs going overseas, and he said, yeah, but Tom, do you really care about Cleveland?
I didn't hear him say that. Did he say that,
yeah,
really?
Yeah, and then you said, I care about America. And
oh, yes, I remember
that. I thought that was a great response.
Yeah.
But he actually said that, and I'm thinking, well, I care about Cleveland, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I just thought that was kind of shocking. Oh, and by the way, my response to Machiavelli, I'd say don't go to the dark side, Luke.
Yeah, there you go.
Thanks, Tom.
Use the force. Thank you very much. Great to hear from you, Jim. Vito in Bronx, New York, listening to WWRL. Hey, Vito, what's on your mind?
Yeah, the question I had was, during his speech, Chris Christie said that this president had added $5 trillion to the national debt. But the number that was up there was $15 trillion.
Right.
And I could be wrong. But shouldn't the answer to the question be, who else added that $10 billion?
Yeah, well, it was all Republicans, or virtually all Republicans, and it started with Ronald Reagan, number one. And number two, you're saying the president added this to the debt. Okay, about half, there's a great chart where you can see this over at the Center for American Progress's Think Progress blog. They've got it laid out. About half of the national deficit, the annual deficit that we run, is the result of the Bush tax cuts. Okay, so there's that. And then you've got another third of it that is wars in Afghanistan and you know, the cost of winding up the war in Iraq. And then you got a chunk of it that's Medicare Part D, the fact that the Republicans won't let the government negotiate for lower drug prices. And then you've got the recession caused by George Bush's policies and deregulation and crashing the economy. So please tell me, what part of that deficit is Barack Obama responsible for?
Well, that's what I'm saying, that Chris Christie said it was $5 trillion. The rest has to be on them.
Yeah.
When Bush came to the presidency, there was a surplus.
Yeah.
The surplus is gone. All that, the majority of that debt is on the Republican head.
Yeah, but that's why you did not hear the name George W. Bush last night. You won't hear it tonight either. You will not see a picture of Dick Cheney and an homage to fill in the blank, you know, Jay Bybee and all these guys from the administration. It's like they're going to pretend like the Bush administration never happened, because George W. Bush ran up this debt. When George Bush came into office, there was such a surplus that he was about to pay off the national debt. In fact, after the break, I will play you the audio clip of George W. Bush in his first address to Congress after he became president, saying, "We've got such a surplus now from Bill Clinton that we are going to pay off the national debt." He said it to the world. He said it before Congress in 2001. Vito, thanks a lot for the call. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So where is this thing going to go? How long? By the way, you probably didn't notice it, but according to the Gallup poll, Romney's slipping in popularity right now.
This one comes out from the one term go. This one comes out from the one who's a horse it is.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And on the line with us, one of the great reporters in America, David Schuster, with TakeActionNews.com and with Current TV. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Tom, you are very kind. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It is an honor to have you here, as always, David. You are in the belly of the beast. You're down there in Tampa?
Yes, I am. In fact, right now I'm in our workspace, which is in the convention center, this sort of gigantic hall that they divided up with curtains and whatnot for all the workspace. And then we're probably about a block away from the actual Tampa Bay Times Forum, where the arena is that they're having all the events, which
right.
is over to you and report from tonight.
So what's your sense of what went on yesterday, and what's your sense of what's going on today?
I think yesterday was all about starting to try to tear at President Obama, trying to make the point that the Republicans have been making throughout the campaign. They argue that President Obama has not handled the economy well, that the president's methods have not worked, that the president stands for giving things for free to people who don't deserve them. And, oh, by the way, they slip in that Republicans believe in America as if President Obama does not. Mm-hmm. It was remarkable to hear on a couple different levels, both the social issues last night, whether it's Chris Christie or Rick Santorum, who talked a lot about his sort of faith and sort of underscoring that. But I think where one thing that's missing, and you hear this from some Republican strategists who are watching this unfold, and this is maybe where the news is that the polling will indicate, at least the Republicans are doing the focus groups, is that Mitt Romney is still not very well liked, and there's a lot of people don't know about him. And the person who was supposed to fill in the gaps last night, at least start to do it, was Ann Romney. Most of her speech was not so much with anecdotes and memorable things about Mitt Romney, but more sort of the state of politics. And so there's at least some grumbling here among Republicans, not the campaign, that they feel that Romney is losing enough, that
yeah.
he has the attention. He's not filling in the gaps he needs.
Well,
to.
Gallup overnight, he dropped a point.
Yeah, and then that may be, you know, I think the theory among both Republicans and Democrats who agree on this is that people have already made up their mind about President Obama. I mean, you either like President Obama, you don't like President Obama. Nothing you hear is really going to change that. Where people aren't sure is some people haven't quite made up their minds about Mitt Romney. And so to the extent Romney and the campaign are coming across as sort of mean or insensitive and all the anecdotes that may add to that, and people are hearing that as opposed to, well, here's the guy who's got some confidence, who's got some business experience, and he'll take care of America or whatnot, or whatever their sort of rallying cry is, to the extent that people aren't hearing that, I think that's a problem for Republicans that you're even starting to hear from folks who are down here.
That's very interesting. Is there, buyer's remorse is probably the wrong phrase, but is there, among the Republicans there, looking at the speeches that were given last night, which were supposed to be coronation of Mitt Romney and how wonderful Mitt Romney is, and instead were, you know, John Kasich bragging about how, you know, Obama saving the auto industry has brought back Ohio Chris Christie, quoting Niccolo Machiavelli or paraphrasing him and putting the words in his mother's mouth. is there a concern that there was way too much me among these guys and not enough Mitt Romney?
Well, that's a great point and worth exploring, because when you look at the speeches that are being given that were given last night, Rick Santorum, Chris Christie tonight, Paul Ryan, of course, the vice presidential nominee, but you also have Jeb Bush and Mike Huckabee and Condoleezza Rice. It's almost like the convention is all about featuring the people who may want to run 4 years from now if Mitt Romney loses. That the sort of the payoff that Mitt Romney has to give them is to give them a prime slot at the convention. But they're all trying to outdo one another in terms of trying to impress this crowd. So, yes, there's a little bit about Mitt Romney, and certainly there's a lot about tearing down President Obama. But, as you heard with Chris Christie last night, it was so much about Chris Christie.
Sure. Yeah, this was his, 2016 campaign. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that you were the guy who broke the story of an African-American CNN news person or camera person having peanuts thrown at him or her by one of the people at the RNC saying, this is how we feed the animals. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I was the first to sort of put it out, but credit where credit is due. That came initially from our photographer, Steve Coombs, who I've worked with for a long time here at Current. And he talked to some folks at CNN who saw the incident happen, told me about it. Then we went through sort of the normal reporting process to make sure that they were on the up and up and we knew who it was. And then got some confirmation from CNN, although CNN wouldn't put out a statement. But the basic story of it was that, yes, there were two people who were credentialed, but it's not clear whether they were delegates or alternates. We can't get that information out of from CNN or from the RNC. But they were heckling an African-American woman who was a photographer for CNN. She takes one of these cameras and points it at reporters and the crowd and whatnot, and she was either on the floor or just off the floor. They were heckling her. They were heckling her, and she was ignoring it. And then they started throwing peanuts or peanut shells at her. And one of them said that could be loudly heard by other people, this is how we feed the animals.
Well, why were they heckling her? Because she was black or because they didn't like her taking their pictures or something?
Well, she wasn't taking pictures of them. So it's, what was motivating them, it certainly appears like it was racist, and that's how it was motivated.
Yeah,
so
good old boys from the South.
At that point, she complained. The security got called over. There were other people in the crowd who helped identify who these knuckleheads were, and they threw them out. The problem, I think, with this is that this didn't get reported by CNN last night. Right. We were able to get it just because of contacts that we have among the CNN staff and tech, and because of the work of our cameraman Steve Coombs, who knew these people and talked to them and sort of gave us the first lead on this.
Sure.
But it was only after 11 o'clock when CNN finally put out a statement, confirming publicly that this had happened and a little bit of details. And then today, they put a report out on their website saying it was two people. The RNC called this deplorable, but still, with a lot of things we don't know. Were these delegates? Which state were they from? Who was the camera person? Is she willing to be identified? But what exactly happened?
Is the RNC genuinely horrified, or are they just going to try and brush it under the rug because, hey, this is just part of their racial strategy?
My sense is it's the latter, unfortunately, and I don't think I don't think people feel that way. But but they're mad that it's caught, and it's deplorable, and you shouldn't throw peanuts at people.
Way,
I guess.
We can all agree on that. But there is so much coded racism in what the RNC is doing right now, and these ads with these lies in them. David Schuster, TakeActionNews.com, Current TV. Thank you, David.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And that was David Schuster. We will be back with more live from Washington, D.C. and live from Tampa, Florida. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. It is 35 minutes past the hour, and our guest on Skype. Our guest is Brigham A. McCown, if I have that right. Brigham, do I have that right?
You have that absolutely 100% correct.
And you are an energy policy advisor to Mitt Romney?
I'm an energy policy surrogate.
Okay, great.
But I'll take the promotion if you want.
Okay, that's fine. So how do we get to a position where we can tell Saudi Arabia, sorry, we don't need you anymore?
Well, we can actually do that. I think Mr. Romney's plan and those that developed that plan will tell you, with a little extra drilling on public lands, with speeding up some permits with getting Keystone XL in line, we can absolutely displace Saudi Arabian oil.
Well, now, the Keystone XL pipeline is to, first of all, it's a Canadian corporation. Secondly, the Republican Party just last night affirmed their opposition to the Kelo decision, to taking land by eminent domain, and yet that's how most of that pipeline is being taken. And third, the whole point of, I mean, there's already a Keystone pipeline that goes to the Midwest, as you, I'm sure you know, and provides a lot of gasoline to the Midwest. When that's extended all the way down to the Gulf Coast, it's going to be mostly for export to China and Mexico. It's not, it's actually probably going to raise the price of gasoline in the United States, although, you know, it's going to also raise the number of cancers downwind from the refineries down there.
Well, I don't see where that solves anything. Oh, actually, I beg to differ. First of all, let's take your first premise that all this oil is going to be exported. That's just simply wrong. If you look
well,
at the
company page, says that it's going to be exported. The company that's, you know, TransCanada, they say this is for export.
Well, TransCanada doesn't even own it. They're simply a shipper, so they have no say-so in the matter.
This is their pipeline.
Yeah, but see, they're a common carrier shipper, and I think this is something that a lot of people don't understand. Keystone is a common carrier. They don't own the oil. They simply ship it. And so they have no say-so in where the oil goes, and I would be shocked if you could find me a TransCanada executive in writing that says that, because that's nonsense.
But, you know, Brigham, you must know that last year the biggest export, manufactured export of the United States was gasoline.
Was diesel and distillates, and that's
yeah.
true.
Yeah, and this pipeline is all about increasing that. But let's not, you know, have this be a he said she said. You know, we've both put our positions forward on this. I'm just wondering why you and the Romney campaign are arguing so strongly for 19th century fuel systems like fossil fuels, coal, oil, gas, when it's the 21st century.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, these are the same arguments that were brought by the pro-renewable in the Jimmy Carter period. We're not there yet. I'm a conservationist. I want to see renewables. I am all for wind. But look, hey, look, you've got Germany coming out this morning and saying, hey, we need to pare back on our green agenda because it sounds good on paper, but it's too expensive for the consumer. I'm not saying
no, that is not what Germany said. Excuse me. I've spent a fair amount of time in Germany. We've interviewed several German members of parliament on this program. We've talked about the German program.
Yeah.
They put that original subsidy in place where actually it didn't cost anybody anything, because what they said is the banks will loan at 2%. They will give you a mortgage to put a solar panel on your house for a 10-year period. You buy the solar panel, you pay that off during that 10-year period. During that 10-year period, the power companies buy electricity from you at 7 times the normal rate. And at the end of that 10-year period, the power companies will have spent an amount equal to one nuclear power plant, and we will have put enough solar panels on people's houses to generate a gigawatt of electricity, or 100 megawatt, or whatever a nuclear power plant is. Yeah, a gigawatt. So we won't have to have built a nuclear power plant. Everybody wins. Their goal was to build the equivalent of 2 nuclear power plants in 10 years. Instead, they built 10. They had so much surplus electricity that their grid can't handle it. They've got to upgrade their grid now. And so that's why they're cutting back on the subsidies, because their program was too successful.
Well, if you listen to the news coming out of Reuters this morning on a couple of the German ministers, that's a different issue. But that's not what they're saying. They're saying that the Green Revolution is going
well,
to
you should go there. You take a train across Germany, as I do several times a year. A third of all the houses have solar panels on them.
Oh, I know. As a member of the U.S. military, I spend a lot of time in Germany. So, no, I totally agree with you. But, you know, the reason why Germany, for example, is into renewables is they don't want to be held hostage from natural gas supplies coming from Russia. But look, that's totally a different deal.
And they don't want to burn their own coal because they're concerned about global warming and because they have no oil.
If we take coal off the table, if we take oil off the table, if we take natural gas, Obama wants to take hydro off the table, we're left with bicycles and an agrarian society.
Oh, that's nonsense.
That's nonsense.
Iowa and Texas right now are both producing 20% of their electricity with wind.
Well, the fact is we need a true all-the-above energy plan, not one that gives lip service to certain ones. We need all the tools in the toolbox, and that's what the Romney plan is arguing for. We're not saying we want to return to 19th century, but we're saying you have to be realistic, and we have to use all the tools in the toolbox, and the government in a capitalist world can't be picking winners and losers. That's just not
I think the government absolutely should be picking winners and losers, because some of those, you've got a situation right now where we're, the government is picking oil and coal companies as winners by subsidizing them, and those subsidies, which might have made sense in the late 19th century when we were trying to build an industrial infrastructure, those subsidies are now leading to global warming, which is destroying the planet and even caused you guys to have to delay your convention by a day. And why shouldn't we the people say, it would be better for us to have solar panels than to have nuclear power plants or have oil or coal like the Germans did, or like the Danes did with their wind power, like the Chinese are doing. Why don't we just rationally say, you know, this would be a better thing for us?
Well, are you okay with nuclear power?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Look, if you take everything that you're against off the table, you want us to live in an agrarian society. That just doesn't work.
I am not suggesting an overnight transformation, but I am suggesting that if we were to take the kinds of subsidies that we've been giving to the fossil fuel industry and instead put those subsidies into renewables, we could transform this country. We could become the beacon of energy for the future. And in my opinion, government should be picking that winner, because that's a good thing for us.
No.
So you think that instead the corporate free market should be deciding this, that the CEOs should be deciding who's going to be the winners and losers?
The consumer should be deciding. That's why we live in a free state. This isn't a socialist state. This isn't, you know, some totalitarian state where the president gets up and says, this is how it's going to be, boys. You have to let the free market pick. And the free market,
the corporate free market, just constantly screws us.
Well, it's the consumer. It's the consumer.
No, the consumer is not sitting around saying, gee, what should be our energy policy over the next 15 years? No, those decisions are either being made by government or they're being made by corporate CEOs. And your corporate free market is always going to work to the benefit of profits for the corporations. And the rest of us should be thinking, and government should be thinking, about what's the best thing for the United States of America.
Well, I agree that we should all be thinking about what's the best interest of the U.S.
Then why are you saying that the corporate free market is more important than that the interests of the corporate free market is more important than the interests of the United States of America?
The corporate
free market should be picking the winners and losers rather than we the people.
Well, no, I think you've got a very skewed sense there. And if we start to the point where even you can't sell a made in the USA product overseas, as you're suggesting we should ban exports, now you're talking.
I'm not suggesting we should ban exports.
Well, you're saying Keystone will only take U.S. product made in America and export it. And
no, it's taking a Canadian product. It's transporting it across the United States. It's refining it and dumping all of the externalities, all of the waste products into the air down in Louisiana and Texas, and then exporting that gasoline. It just seems stupid to me when we could take that same amount of time and effort and money and Fifth Amendment, you know, taking of properties, and build wind farms all across that, frankly, across the Keystone Pipeline thing.
Well, let me ask this. How is that any different from taking lumber from Canada, turning it into a manufactured product, and selling it overseas? By your analogy, we shouldn't do that either.
Well, lumber is renewable. Oil is not.
Oil is renewable. It's natural. That's
well,
how it's, it
it's renewable in if you're talking in 300 million year cycles, yeah.
Well,
but
I'm not, but I'm saying it's a natural element is my point.
Well, so is arsenic. That doesn't, you know, mean that we, you know, we should be eating it. I mean, it's organic, but.
Oh, man. Well.
Is the basis of your energy policy that there is no such thing as global warming and so we shouldn't be worried about fossil fuels?
No, I don't personally have an opinion on global warming. I think it is something that we have to take very seriously.
So if you're going to ignore all the science on global warming and don't have a personal opinion on that, how can you be a surrogate on energy policy?
Well, look, the fact is the current administration doesn't have an energy policy, and we need to come up with one. But the energy policy of the United States can't be demonizing all of the forms of energy that we use to actually run our economy. That's unrealistic.
I'm not suggesting demonizing them. I'm saying let's move the subsidies into 21st century forms. Last word to you, Brigham.
Well, we're going to have to respectfully agree to disagree, but we need all forms on the table, and we can't be...
Okay. Great. Thank you
very
much.
Thanks so much.
Got it. Brigham A. McCown. He's the energy policy advisor to Mitt Romney. And we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
46 minutes past the hour. More from Tampa and from Washington, D.C. right after this opportunity for you to support your local station. Slightly unbalanced. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Michael Steele, the former chairman of the Republican National Committee, is the committee and convention. What would it be? How do you say it there, Michael?
Hey, man, I'm just a former chairman. That's how you do it.
Former chairman. Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, great to have you with us. And,
it's great to be with you.
And thank you for joining us. And you know, very much thank you for joining us. What is the sense? Last night I heard all these speeches, and I heard all about how wonderful Ohio is now that, you know, President Obama has saved the auto industry. And I heard about how Chris Christie's mom was quoting Niccolo Machiavelli to him and teaching him lessons, you know, on her knee. And I learned all this stuff about these people. I didn't hear anybody say anything about Mitt Romney other than he's a good guy. Is he getting burned by this?
No, I don't think he's getting burned. Although I will say it's a little bit odd that it, you know, 1,700 words into Chris Christie's speech before he actually mentions Romney's name. But I think it was sort of setting up the biography, the comparative biography, talking about you know, individual personal experiences and trying to relate that out. I don't think he's getting burned per se. The goal here, and of course, the emphasis really was less about the keynote and really more about Ann Romney. I thought Ann Romney, in many respects, kind of laid out a nicer and more eloquent, you know, expose, if you will, about their marriage, obviously, but certainly about the man. I think the only sort of hiccup for me was I thought the Christie speech should have gone first. And I thought you you should have ended it with sort of that warm moment, particularly with the kiss. Right, you do the fade to black and that's it. So people walk away with a feel good. As opposed to the anxious rah-rah of Christie's speech. But they both were very strong speeches in their own right.
The Republican Party, and not just the Republican Party, but their surrogates, the PACs and all this stuff,
right.
they're running this ad that has this blatant lie in it about Obama wanting to do away with work requirements for welfare. They're doubling down on this thing. Everybody has called them out as liars on it. And yet, apparently, it is resonating with some white voters who, you know, it's always been fashionable to kick around people on welfare. I mean, there's probably never been a time in American politics when it hasn't been somewhat successful to pick on poor people, other than maybe the 1930s. And this is working for Romney. Are you guys going to continue using lies and distortions in your advertising?
It's not a you guys, because I don't have any decision-making power. I'm not in the campaign.
Okay,
is
the Republican Party going to continue doing this?
Well, again, that's not the Republican Party. That's the individual PAC that's running the ad. And
is that Karl Rove's PAC? Is that GPS?
I think it's GPS, a GPS ad.
So,
I can only speak to what I've said and what I know, and that is, there's no place for this crap in the campaign. The American people want substance. They want the debate to be elevated. We need to move away and shy away from the kinds of rhetoric and words that can be construed or misconstrued to mean something that they don't. And so that we can have a clean, honest discussion about how we put America back to work, how we empower small businesses. And I think and I hope coming out of this convention, that's the attitude that people have. If not, I'll tell you straight up, if not, this is going to be a long, ugly campaign. It's going to be a Seinfeld-esque campaign about nothing. And the American people will feel that its leadership once again has failed them. And that doesn't lead to a good place.
Right.
So my hope is that we all do better, both Barack Obama and his team, and the people that, you know, he says he can't control, and Mitt Romney and his team and the people he says he can't control, all get out there and understand that it's the American people that ultimately have the control.
Well, there was that one dishonest, shall we say, or less than fully honest ad that was run by one of the PACs, you know, that Obama has no control over. Obama came out and condemned it, and they pulled the ad. The PAC pulled the ad.
Yeah.
Now you've got Karl Rove running an ad that is full of lies, and everybody's condemning it. You just called it crap. I mean, God bless you. I totally agree with you. And Karl Rove is saying, we're going to do more of this.
Well, you know, look, again, this is something that the American people are going to challenge back on. The campaigns are going to have to deal with. There comes a point, quite honestly, where enough is enough. And, you know, while I think people think it will have the intended effect, it could very literally backfire on them. It could become a real problem for the campaign. We even saw recently, and this is why the ad you're referring to about inferring that Romney, you know, time at Bain resulted in the death of this man's wife.
That ad appeared for less than a week because it got debunked, basically.
Well, yeah, exactly. And so the point is, and, you know, we can argue whether or not that is a worse or better ad than the one that's currently running. The point is, it's inappropriate.
Yeah.
Whether you infer.
Well, and
you
the
know,
bigger point is that it got pulled. And that Rove's lie ad is not only running, they're throwing more money at it.
Right. And so if you want to take the risk to further alienate those independent voters who find the ad to be a distortion or an outright lie, then right. You're going to run that risk. And you'll see that reflected in the polls. And guess what? They'll get it.
Maybe. I mean, you know, you've got the Republican Party has 0% of the African-American vote. So,
right.
You know, they're reaching out to whites aggressively and, you know, using this word welfare, which even though you and I both know more than 60% of Americans who are on welfare are white, nonetheless, welfare is code in political circles and has been for a long time since Nixon's Southern Strategy. It's code for black people. And this is just, I am.
Well, let me tell you what my frustration is. My frustration is that every time we talk about welfare in this country, we immediately jump to black in the first place. That says as much about the African American community to allow that to happen as it does about white folks who do it. So, you know, we all need to get off of that dime in a heartbeat, because the reality of it is, you know, for the wealth that's generated within the black community, even among those who are poor, it's important that we recognize that everybody aspires to something better. And I think that's
absolutely
the message.
Absolutely. And most of the poverty in America is in the white community.
Yeah,
And we need to do something about that, too. Michael Steele, former chairman of the Republican National Committee, the RNC. Michael, real quickly, why did you flip the stars upside down?
Why did I flip the stars upside down? I didn't.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, here's the history. I find this just hysterical. 1513 was the year. A fellow by the name of Niccolo Machiavelli was trying to get a job as the advisor to the prince of Italy at the time. And he ultimately didn't get the job, but he wrote this book called The Prince, which was about how princes should govern. And chapter 17 of the book is titled Concerning Cruelty and Clemency and Whether It Is Better to Be Loved Than Feared. He says, coming now to the other qualities mentioned above, I say that every prince ought to desire to be clement and not cruel. Upon this, a question arises, whether it is better to be loved than feared or feared than loved. It may be answered that one should wish to be both, but because it is difficult to unite them in one person, it is much safer to be feared than loved. When of the two, either must be dispensed with. And why is this? He says it's because men are ungrateful, fickle, false, cowardly, covetous, etc., etc., and you just basically can't trust them, so it's better to have them fear you than love you. He says, nevertheless, a prince ought to inspire fear in such a way that if he does not win love, he avoids hatred. flash forward to about a decade ago in the movie A Bronx Tale. And here's the long version. Here you got two mafiosa, two mob guys talking to each other. Young guy talking to the older guy, right? The older guy is the mentor, and he's telling the younger guy, here's how you do it, right? Here's the story.
Is it better to be loved or feared?
It's a good question. It's nice to be both, but it's very difficult. But if I had my choice, I would rather be feared. Fear lasts longer than love. Friendships that are bought with money mean nothing. You see how it is around here. I make a joke, everybody laughs. I know I'm funny, but I'm not that funny. It's fear that keeps them loyal to me. But the trick is not to be hated. That's why I treat my men good, but not too good. I give them too much, then they don't need me. I give them just enough where they need me, but they don't hate me.
Yeah. So then flash forward to maybe, I don't know, 40, 50 years ago. And Chris Christie's mom bouncing him on her knee and saying, son, someday you are going to have to choose between being loved or being respected. Now, you wonder, was that the word? But, you know, respected, feared, it's kind of the same. So clip number one, Shano.
The greatest lesson that mom ever taught me, though, was this one. She told me there would be times in your life when you have to choose between being loved and being respected. Now, she said to always pick being respected.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the hell with being loved. I mean, it's like, you know, you give love is fickle. You can't trust love. Are you kidding? You want people to respect you. That's more important. Why? Because they will then what? Well, let's continue the conversation. Here's Chris Christie again.
I believe we have become paralyzed by our desire to be loved. Now, our founding fathers had the wisdom to know that social acceptance and popularity were fleeting, and that this country's principles needed to be rooted in strengths greater than the passions and the emotions of the times. But our leaders today have decided it's more important to be popular, to say and do what's easy, and say yes rather than to say no. When no is what is required.
That's interesting. I thought the job of a politician was neither to be loved nor to be respected, but to do the will of the people. And if the majority of the people want you to say yes to something, you do so. And if the majority of the people want you to say no to something, you do so. And occasionally there's a judgment call that, you know, where you've got to step out and have some leadership, and then you make a decision. But always say no? Maybe this is why Chris Christie's state is one of the, what is it, number three in the nation at the bottom in terms of unemployment rate at 9.6. He's got one of the worst unemployment rates in the country. He's got an economy in the tank. Because he took on, you know, in part, he took on the teachers union. You know, bust these people up, fire them, send them away, get them off the payroll. Now you don't have people with a paycheck anymore. People don't have paychecks. They're not paying taxes. They're not buying things. They don't buy things. The store, the people in the stores are not getting any income. And you know how it kind of echoes through, and all of a sudden you've got an economy like New Jersey. And why they would pick somebody like Chris Christie to come in and, you know, roll him in oh, no, I'm not going to do fat jokes. Why they would pick a guy like Chris Christie, you know, basically a mean-spirited, less than candid, shall we say, politician, to give the keynote speech. And what was the keynote? Because a keynote is supposed to be the key note of a conference. I've given a lot of keynote speeches in a lot of conferences in my life. And basically, you know, if the conference is a conference on, you know, educating our children in the best way possible. I've spoken at a bunch of education conferences. I've written 7 books on education and ADD and things like that. And so, you know, if the job that they give me, if they say, okay, you know, here, we're going to give you a couple grand speaker fee if you'll come in and you'll give the keynote speech, and the title of the conference is how do we improve, you know, improving the quality of our children's education. What that means is, to me, is as the guy who's got to write my own keynote speech and then deliver it, is that my speech needs to reflect what the conference is all about. It's the keynote speech, after all. It's the key note. It's like the main tone in a song. It's like the main theme in the story. And so the keynote speech has to be the speech that kind of summarizes what the conference is all about. It's why we're here. It's what we're all about. It's what we care about. And Chris Christie spends most of the keynote speech talking about himself and about New Jersey. And 1,800 words into it, he gets around to finally discussing this poor schlub who's sitting over on the sidelines, and they kept going to him by the camera, and you could see the look on his face like, when's he going to mention my name? Is he going to mention my name? Do you think he should? I mean, this is the Republican National Convention this is the coronation of Mitt Romney. And finally, at the end, he's like, oh, yeah, and by the way, vote for Mitt Romney, please. But don't forget, I'm a guy that is more, you know, I got more people respecting me than loving me. That's the keynote? I mean, what has happened to the Republican Party? Well, I can tell you very simply, it's been hijacked by 23 billionaires, in large part, and a few transnational corporations. But it's like, this is, at a certain level, it's like watching high tragedy. You know, over at DU, there's a link to the overnight Gallup polls. Romney dropped a point last night. I mean, if I was watching John Kasich bragging about how Ohio is doing really, really well right now, and Ohio, of course, you know, is the auto industry is a major part of Ohio. And who was it who saved the auto industry? And who was it who wrote the op-ed saying let Detroit fail or let Detroit go bankrupt for the New York Times? Oh, that was Mitt Romney. And who was it who saved Detroit? And it wasn't just Detroit. It was Detroit and Toledo and Cleveland and all the, you know, and it was Ohio. And John Kasich was trying to take credit for that last night, trying to take credit for President Obama's stimulus package and President Obama's, you know, bailout or whatever you want to call it, of the auto industry. I just, you know, I watched that thing last night with my mouth open through at least half of it. It was just astounding, the level of mendacity. I don't have a better word for it. That was coming out of the RNC last night.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So enough about 1516 and Niccolo Machiavelli. Well, let's get on to some of the real issues that are happening here in the United States and pick up a few of your calls, too.
Dr. Na-na.
Say my name, no one is around you. Say, baby, I love you. You ain't running game. Say my name, you acting kind of shady. Ain't calling me baby. Why the sudden change?
Welcome back. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. David Park is on the line with us live from Tampa, Florida at the RNC. He is with the Job Creators Alliance. He's president and CEO of Austin Capital LLC. The website jobcreatorsalliance.org/leaders. And the Job Creators Alliance was formed by entrepreneurs to give a voice to small business, the engine of job creation. David, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. You've started a business, apparently, Austin Capital. This is a company that you began from scratch?
Yes. In fact, I started when I was 24, about 21 years ago. It doesn't seem that long, but that was 21 years ago that I started.
Okay, great. And I've built up and sold off five companies. I've started seven companies and sold off five of them. So here we are, a couple of entrepreneurs.
Absolutely.
How, in your mind, how do we best encourage entrepreneurship in the United States?
I think one of the two factors that I hear most often when I travel the country from small business in particular, small business being defined by companies under 500 employees, they tell me two things. One is to try to get rid of the uncertainty, and number two, taxes is in the forefront of their
mind. Let's take those one at a time. Uncertainty. Can you please tell me any time in the history of the United States when there was no uncertainty, when people knew that who was going to be the next, you know, every 2 years we have an election, who was going to control Congress, how things were going to be. We've always had uncertainty.
That's a great question. And the way that I answer that question is there's a difference between uncertainty and risk. We've always had risk, and in fact, we need risk in order for you to make money. But the problem that we have right now when we're talking about uncertainty is we're not quite sure not only what's going to happen, but the rules are going to be. So the biggest issue that we
But again, we've never known that. I mean, you know, the EPA came along and during the Nixon administration and suddenly they changed the rules and people had to put scrubbers on. And during the Nixon administration, I think it was, you know, you had to put seatbelts in cars. And so the auto manufacturer, I mean, there's always been uncertainty.
Well, that's not uncertainty. That's risk. So if you say that you have to do something, that is no longer uncertainty. Uncertainty basically means that you're not quite sure not only what's going to happen. So just very similar to if anybody out there listening has ever been concerned about something, but you're not quite sure what the outcome is going to be. You're not quite sure how you're going to resolve these issues. So you sit there and you panic. You sit in bed, you lie up in bed, you wake up every five minutes or so, and you never get any sleep.
So you're telling me that if I own a company and that is making widgets and I get an order for an additional 500 widgets, and in order to make them, I'm going to have to hire a guy to an extra guy for my assembly line. I'm going to say, you know, I'm so uncertain. I'm waking up in the middle of the night in cold sweats. I'm not going to hire this guy. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
There is a certain amount of people that are sitting on their hands. And in fact, let me give you an example. So in order to kind of fix this economy, and I get this quite a bit of how and what we should do in order for us to get the long-term sustainable growth, there are about $1.7 trillion sitting in cash right now in corporate America.
Yeah, in the neighborhood of $2 trillion, yeah.
Yeah, and so when you're taking a look at what the norm is...
In the United States, there's another $3 to $5 trillion outside the United States held by corporate America.
That's right. But within the United States, that we can deploy in the United States without having been double taxation, we're sitting on $1.7 trillion to $2 trillion. And in most cases, without that uncertainty, if they knew what the rules were of how much they're going to be taxed, what health care was going to cost for them, they could deploy that down to about $400 billion, which is about what we should be at.
See, that sounds like total nonsense to me, respectfully, David. It just sounds like total nonsense. I can't understand why any business person would say, you know, I'm not going to make business decisions. I'm not going to run ads for my product. I'm not going to manufacture more product. I'm not going to grow my company if there's demand for it. Why they wouldn't make decisions based on the state of their business rather than uncertainty. I mean, this, you know, Paul Krugman calls it the uncertainty fairy. I mean, it seems to me like a fairy tale.
It's really not. So let me just kind of inject here for one quick second. So if they deploy that money because they knew if they invested that capital in their company, they would be able to quantifiably say that this is a type of return that we would get, and that is something that's measurable. They would deploy that. We would be able to double our growth overnight without increasing taxes, without doing anything to add to the deficit. We would probably lower our unemployment rate by at least 2 to 3 points easily within 6 to 9 months.
Where is the demand coming from?
So the demand in itself, from a consumption standpoint, can easily come from the investments that are being made.
How? Demand is what drives economies. And demand is the 95% of the source of demand, and even Milton Friedman agrees with this, is wages.
So let me just say that in my opinion, there are too much attention towards consumption and not enough through producers. Let me give you an example. Before there was an iPad, there was no demand for an iPad. The consumption for iPad didn't exist. Before there were eggs, there was no demand for eggs. So instead of saying that we should worry about the consumers, we should worry about invention, we should worry about people that have $1.7 trillion in capital that can deploy that, invest in it, in the hopes that they are able to create demand.
So you're telling me that Apple is not developing new products because they're afraid of uncertainty.
You're talking about one very specific company out of hundreds of thousands.
Or any other rational company.
I am saying exactly that people are sitting on their hands rather than deploying their capital.
I think they're sitting on their capital because they're concerned that there's an international global financial crash coming and that may be what you're referring to when you say uncertainty, because the fundamentals are so screwed up. We have no functional trade policy in this country. We have no energy policy. We have no manufacturing policy. And, you know, it's like 30 years of Reaganomics has totally screwed this country.
I would have to respectfully disagree. Since I'm hearing music, I'm assuming we're done.
Yeah, you get the point.
We're going to agree to disagree. Okay. But I will tell you, there is going to be demand, and people are willing to make that investment if there were certainty in taxes and certainty in other areas, including regulation.
Okay, great. Thank David Park, hang on just a second, David, here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm sorry, that guy always steps on me. David Park with the Job Creators Alliance, jobcreatorsalliance.org. Thank you, David.
Thank you for having me.
Young Turks song, or the Young Heart. Yeah, okay, well, that's appropriate. Michael Schur is with us, political correspondent with Current TV, part of the Young Turks with Cenk Uygur. And Michael, hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be here, Tom.
So you are in Tampa at the RNC?
Yes, a strange place to be, I've got to tell you. But I am here, and aside from sweating like crazy and going through what is like a green zone barricade of security every day, twice a day to get in here, having a good time.
Yeah, okay. I'm curious, is there a sense among the delegates or among the Republicans there that they got badly burned last night by a bunch of politicians standing up and grandstanding and talking about themselves and not talking about the presidential candidate when the whole goal of this convention is to get the candidate elected president?
I did, Tom, talk to some people about the fact that Mitt Romney did not seem to be at all the focus last night, even curiously from his wife. And that was, I think, one of the things that really kind of irked us all was that, you know, we thought it was strange because she was the one who was going to present to America this image of a man she fell in love with, a man that she, you know, wanted everyone to see the soft side of. She hardly mentioned his name.
Well, she didn't tell a single story. That was the thing that amazed me. I figured that she would at least say, you know, oh, there was this time when one of our kids, you know, fell and broke his arm, and Mitt called up and had, you know, one of our special chauffeurs take him to the hospital, you know, or something. You know, you expect something. But
she made no light either of the things that people sort of pick on him for, you know, the sort of the robotic presence that he has. She didn't say, yeah, Mitt's a stiff guy. We joke about it. There's nothing I can do about that. But deep inside that Herman Munster, there's a soft man. You know, there was none of that.
One of these days I'm going to get a whoopee cushion for him, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Exactly. There was nothing like that. And like you said, Tom, there was no anecdote. Nobody here is telling stories today about, oh, wasn't it sweet when Ann said fill in the blank? Because Ann didn't say anything that was memorable.
Right, which is really kind of tragic when you think about it. You would think that, given that this is a multi-$100 million event and part of a multi-$1 billion event in the election, and they've got, in theory, some of the best consultants in the world. I mean, I ran an ad agency for 7 years and I worked in the business for about 15 years, but, you know, I don't represent myself as the world's, you know, number one genius on advertising and PR, but even to me, it was obvious that last night was a disaster.
It was a disaster. I don't know what happened either. I mean, you could say, well, the day off sort of took momentum out of it. But even early in the night, as people came on stage, there was no energy from that crowd. It was told to us, in fact, that they were told to put the volume up because the crowd was so somber last night early on. The only big ovation that happened, and it took a while to get to him, was Scott Walker. He got a huge ovation.
Sure.
Then, of course, when Chris Christie took the stage, there was some energy behind him, but that was... those were from the Christie 2016 people. Those weren't from the Romney 2012 people.
Right, right. Who are the Romney 2012 people? Are they around? And also, the other, apropos of that as well, is what's going on with the Ron Paul people?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. Two different questions. The Romney 2012 people, Tom, are, you know, I think are the people that sheepishly put on their Romney Ryan pins in the morning and sort of walk over here through the police and through the security. They get here, they hold their signs up, but they don't seem to be doing it as any sort of with any passion at all. They seem to be doing it as a rite of passage. In other words, they have to get through this. I wasn't at the 1996 Republican convention, but I sort of feel there's a sort of Robert Dole-ness about this.
I was just thinking of Bob Dole. I almost said that. This sounds just like the way that people felt about Bob Dole.
And that's exactly the kind of feeling I got in there, having not, you know, sort of remembering it from television, not remembering from having been there. Yeah. It was really just kind of down. Now, to go to the Ron Paul question, you know, the whole thing with Ron Paul is last night it was the Republicans coming out finally and doing, you know, voter ID and voter suppression to their own people, to the Republicans in the hall. They were saying, all right, you cast 20 votes for him, you got 20 delegates, we're only going to give you 10. The contest committee said that. The credentials committee said that. Then they sit down and they walk out. And that was sort of, you know, it didn't impact the evening. It was during the roll call, but it certainly sort of cast a pall, but I'm not going to say, well, I guess I just did.
Yeah.
But it
bad
kind of,
fun,
it,
but
there was
it's some, okay.
sort of, you know, a bit of weirdness, around the hall for just a moment. And that was it. You know, then he's gone. It's like Ron Paul is gone. They want nothing to do with him. But they don't want a whole lot more to do with Mitt Romney.
Isn't Ron Paul's son Rand going to speak?
He is going to speak, and the question is whether he's going to take his father's mantle or he's going to embrace Romney. You know, one of the issues with Ron Paul was that he himself was going to speak. Yesterday, he said he decided not to, and the reason being that the Romney people wanted to vet his speech and they wanted to make sure he endorsed him. That Paul endorsed Romney, and that wasn't going to happen, apparently. So it'll be interesting to see if Rand Paul makes this a speech about his father, because everybody seems to be making this a speech about anybody but Mitt Romney.
Right, which is the truly strange and weird thing.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts or observations about what you're seeing there that you'd like to share with our viewers and listeners?
Well, I mean, you know, the security is just, for an American, it's an eerie thing, and I, you know, I'm not saying they're doing a bad job, it's just, it's so disproportionate to the number of people here, I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
So the feel that you're getting watching this at home or listening to it, that's one thing that you certainly don't get to experience here. I think that right now the question is, what are we waiting for? You know, are we waiting for Romney's speech? It was supposed to be sort of a lead up to that. There doesn't seem to be a great deal of sort of tension around what's Paul Ryan going to say, what's going to happen with Jeb Bush tonight. This just seems to be the kind of thing where they're marching, going through the motions, waiting for something to happen. That something has not yet happened here.
That's fascinating. Michael Schur, political correspondent with Current TV, part of the Young Turks with Cenk Uygur. Michael, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Hey, Tom, it was a pleasure. Thanks.
Fascinating perspective, and you know, always good to get a report from the guy on the ground. Debbie in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Debbie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. It's nice to talk to you.
Thank you for calling.
One comment is that I think that Ann Romney did well in representing Mitt. I thought one thing she said that really struck me was when it reached down deep and she said, "You can really trust this man."
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was a winner.
Yeah.
You know, even though I don't care for them, I don't care for their policies, and even in disagreement with you, yes, I do think they are evil, because all that they do is evil. It considers nobody but the rich. And not only does it only consider the rich, they want to enslave everybody who don't have what they have and who don't come under their umbrella and do what they say do.
Mm-hmm. And yet, at the same time, he's trustworthy.
Well, yeah, he's trustworthy for what he plans to do.
I see. Okay, yes. I got it. Yeah, he's saying he's the rich guy. He's going to work for the rich people, and you know, of course, you know, Ann was rich. He's rich. They're all rich, and so yeah, she well said. Thanks a lot for the call, Debbie. Lynn in Palmdale, California. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
Hi. You know, you talked about a couple of things, so I'm going to talk about a couple of things that you talked about. Work for welfare.
Yeah.
I want to tell you my story. Years and years ago, because I'm an old woman now, I was on welfare. I had 3 small children, no job skills, because I was a stay-at-home mom and did all the right things we were supposed to do back then. And if I hadn't had welfare to rely on, my children and I would probably be dead today.
Oh, my.
women that are on welfare are women that usually have small children. 75% of my household were people that could not work. 75% of my household were people without any skills. I went to a thing to work, to learn to work, mm-hmm. but my children became very sick. But since I got, I stayed on a year, and after that, I was able to go get a job. I had remarried. I had a job. I've paid my taxes all these years. And before I left my first husband, I paid all my taxes then. So I do not feel like I'm leeching off anybody.
Yep.
Because I had always paid in. I had always done my things. And I resent with a capital R anybody saying welfare people are just people that are there leeching off society.
I agree
with
you.
Children are never leeches. Why do you say no abortion, but you're not there to feed the kids?
Yeah.
Why do you say no abortion, but you're not there to take care of their medical needs? Why do you say, oh, I believe in life, and then say, I'm going overseas and kill everybody else's kids because I don't like the way they think?
Yeah, I know. I
want to know that. I think that sucks. Excuse me.
There are some serious non sequiturs in our society, in our culture, and particularly in the Republican Party right now. I absolutely agree with you, Lynn, and I also agree with this concept. We should stop calling what we are calling entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare, and frankly, the entire social safety net. We should stop calling them entitlement programs and welfare programs and start calling them earned benefit programs, because these are programs that we do, all of us who have worked, have paid into throughout our lives. And even if somebody is taking these benefits who has never worked in their lives, like you said, your children, for example, or somebody who was born with a severe disability and has never been able to work, still it is earned in my mind by their simply being a member of our society. And all of us have put that money into it. And we need to start calling these things earned benefits rather than, you know, entitlements and welfare and whatnot. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that the Republicans are going to use the welfare word as long as they can, because they're using it in a way that is code for race. Well, it seems, you know, that's Karl Rove's strategy. Lynn, thank you very much for the call. And thanks for sharing your story with us. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
46 minutes past the hour. Did you know that spending on prisons has gone up 127% while spending on higher education has only gone up 21%?
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Indeed. Steve in Corvallis, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Oh, yeah, that guy who was pushing Romney's energy policy. It just drives me nuts because, you know, they're just retreading Sarah Palin's drill, baby, drill. And
of course.
It doesn't make any sense because, you know, I remember back in 68, 69, okay, Texas oil producers were having trouble with cheap Saudi crude, so they wanted to have an oil import tax. And everybody says that's nuts. That's a drain America first policy. And, you know, that's basically when Republicans say drill, baby, drill, we should say drain America first.
Yeah, yeah. Really, it is, because it's not, you know, what astounded me is when he said oil is a renewable resource. I'm like, well, yeah, every 300 million years, I suppose, but it didn't make a whole lot of sense. So anyhow, well said. Thank you very much for the call. Mary in Bernie, Texas. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Oh, Tom, I got rant, you wouldn't believe. The like that lady saying that that hit one of them, that Ann was a great manager. Why would she hire a butler if she was going to manage?
Yeah.
But anyway, why don't we tell the truth about Romney while they tell lies about Obama? He was not a child when he was bullying that child and cutting his hair off, and well, his buddies held him down. There's a lot of things that we just ignore about his.
Yeah, and when that story came out, Romney actually apologized for it. You know, I think you have to give him.
He did, but hey, that was a little bit late, though.
Yeah.
I seemed to apologize.
40 years too
man.
Late. Yeah.
Yep, he was no child. And there's, I mean, the man is a shadow. He's nothing.
Yeah.
And we just don't bring anything up.
Yeah, it is remarkable. Mary, thank you for your comments. Well said. Chuck in Mosher, Oregon?
Mosher.
What's up, Chuck?
Yeah. Yeah, if I get it right, I didn't listen to the party last night, but I understand that Ann Romney spoke before Chubby from Jersey.
Yeah, Chris Christie ended the thing, yep.
Right, and the snips that I saw, she was, basing her thing around love and this and that and the other, and then he came on and dissed love.
That's right. He said it's better to be respected than to be loved.
Right, so this harkens back to the energy guy, and this is just going to, it's just another, what we're in for is just a three-ring circus of nobody, they don't even know what's going on themselves.
Yeah. I think you're right.
On a convention floor to talk like that, when they're just anything to shoot Obama down is what it looks like.
And yeah.
If they shoot one another down on the way out there, well, it's like the cops in New York City.
Well, you're talking about when they took out that one guy and shot nine civilians standing around.
Fact,
I mean,
everything's flying around. It doesn't matter to them anymore.
Yeah. Well, I don't think those police officers were necessarily
No, I don't mean the police officers. Yeah. I'm talking about the people that the Republicans.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get your point. I get your metaphor, and it's well said, Chuck. Thanks a lot for sharing it with us. It is a mess. It sure looks like a mess to me anyway. Nate in Chicago. Hey, Nate, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Good. I really appreciate you taking my call. I know you're super modest, but I am a huge fan. I have a lot of respect for you.
Thank you.
And what I wanted to ask you, I really want your opinion on this. In a fair fight, I know Obama would win, hands down.
Big time.
In a straight-up fair fight, right? Well,
yes.
Republicans know that it's not a fair fight. So they're fighting dirty, as usual. Super PACs, I mean, they're outspending us, the voter suppression, and so on.
Right.
So my question is then, what do you think, honestly or realistically, the chances of a major upset? Like somehow they steal the election, it was 2004 all over again. Florida, right?
Yeah. Well, 2004 was Ohio, 2000 was Florida, but they were both stolen elections, in my opinion, and I think that there's a very reasonable possibility that this election will be stolen by the Republicans also, and they'll do it the way that they've been doing it. They've turned this into an art form, knocking people off the voting rolls, intimidating people, preventing people from voting, using electronic voting machines that are questionable. There's a whole variety of and lying in their advertising, and just, getting people out there. And so, we've got to get as many people as possible registered to vote on the ground and showing up and voting and participating. And B, perhaps more important, we need to be exposing what they're up to. And if Mitt Romney wins, then we really have a big job ahead of us in trying to, keep him from doing too much damage to this country. But I'm not even going to go down that road beyond that point. I don't want to even imagine it. But Nate, I think that there's a very real possibility. We need to keep our eyes open, and we need to be talking. There's some people who are working on election integrity, and we need to do whatever we can to help them out. Thanks a lot for the call, Paul. Adrian in Drury, Idaho, we have a minute left in the show. It's all yours.
It's not that dreary. It's dreary.
Okay.
Except that I'm surrounded by Republicans. Would you say that anyone who believes in democracy believes in the right for its citizens to vote, that's a primary part of our democracy?
Thomas Paine said the beating heart of democracy is the vote.
Thank you. Well, then, would you do me a favor? The next time you interview a Republican, would you please ask them for Adrian what they are doing? What is the Republican Party doing to see to it that all eligible citizens have the right to vote? Because what they've done is they've done everything in their power to take it away from certain people in a kind of a sweeping thing that will take out eligible as well.
Yeah.
And then they can sit there letting the Democrats scramble.
No, there is a concerted voter suppression effort being done by the Republican Party. You saw Nikki Haley last night. Thank you for the call, by the way, Adrian. Nikki Haley last night bragging about it and getting applause because they all know, hey, Pennsylvania voter suppression, Mitt Romney. Coming up tomorrow, more news and info from the big Republican circus tent in Tampa, plus conservative commentator Dinesh D'Souza about his new movie 2016, Obama's America. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.